is the Convict Australia podcast. Thank you for tuning in.
Hi, everyone. I would just like to start by acknowledging the Dharawal speaking people, who are the traditional custodians of this land, and I pay my respects to elders both past, present, and future. Today, I'll be talking to Santhila Shingepe. Santhila is a journalist who has created a documentary called Our African Roots, which is inspired by her soon-to-be-released book. In it, she explores colonialism, slavery, and post-colonial migration to Australia. The documentary is soon to be aired on SBS, and I have been very fortunate to see an early viewing. And I've got to say, it's amazing. Welcome to the show, Santhila.
Thanks so much for having me, Jennifer.
So what got you thinking about African history in Australia?
Ooh. Where do you want to start? I guess it's something that I've always been curious about. When I started my career as a journalist, I found that I was gravitating to a lot of stories that explored the experiences of people like me. And I also found that there were almost these sort of different narratives that were taking place. There was the narrative that I was very familiar with, which was reflective of my lived experience, which is that in any community, you've got people from all walks of life with different experiences. And then there was another narrative, which to me was very singular in its depiction, which was essentially around criminality and this sense that people of African descent and African migrants were troublemakers, you know, to put it bluntly. And it was a very difficult thing to try and reconcile because there wasn't any truth to it. I mean, you know, you have people that do bad things in any community. It's not that is limited to a certain group. But I kept wondering, why does this still become the dominant narrative? Why are we so focused on this? And obviously the bigger answer is racism. And by racism, I'm not talking about the way a lot of people understand it, which is this, you know, sort of overt behavior of being bad intentioned, but rather the bigger sort of power structures that have created this advantage and was sort of born out of the transatlantic slave trade, which in itself is a very bigger, complicated thing to try and explain quite simply. But I got to understand that was the origins, and for some weird reason, those histories made their way to this continent. And while a lot of those things have been abolished and outlawed, the legacy of those things continues to exist. And some of that shows up in how we treat different groups of people and how we talk about certain things. And so I was very curious to sort of understand whether or not, because the other thing that I kept hearing was that African migrants, the reason why people of African descent were copying a lot of the, you know, negative media attention or the backlash was it was almost this Aussie rite of passage. You know, every other migrant group has copped it. The Italians, the Greeks, and the Vietnamese. And, you know, so it was just the time for the Africans because they were a newly arrived group. And perhaps there was some truth to it, but then I sort of thought, well, is it really true? Are Africans a recent phenomenon, like the arrival of Africans on this continent, is that a recent thing? Is it a very post-white Australia policy thing? And when I worked at SBS as a journalist, I did a story about a black South African convict called David Sturman. And at the time, his story was there was a South African delegation that was traveling to Sydney to try and locate his remains because they were trying to repatriate him. He was seen as a very revered figure for the Khoisan people. And this was around the time of the 20th anniversary of democracy in South Africa. So it was supposed to be a very big deal of having this homecoming to see if they could repatriate his remains back. And he was transported here as a convict, I think in about in the mid-1830s. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to Robben Island first, so exactly 200 years before Nelson Mandela, and then found his way to Sydney. And you know, during that course of trying to, so I was doing the story and I was sort of a couple of steps ahead of the delegation because before they arrived, I wanted to figure out where his remains were and whether or not they'd have any success. Ended up finding out that actually no, because where they're buried, they'd have no luck trying to retrieve them. And that was sort of the initial introduction to the fact that there was an African presence that was earlier than I had learned. And after the summer of 2018, when there was a lot of rhetoric here in Victoria specifically around African gangs and crime and all this sort of stuff, I just kind of went, you know what, I've had enough. I've had enough of trying to, I guess, use stories to show that people are more than, you know, their identities and all this sort of stuff. So how else can you convince people that the people that look like me have been here for as long as, you know, Europeans, really? And so I heard about, you know, the presence of Africans in the First Fleet. I'd heard about John Caesar. I think I'd gone to an exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria. They had this exhibition called Colony. And it was a fantastic exhibition, if you ever saw it, because it sort of, it got all of this stuff from across the different institutions and put them in the NGV. And it was really looking at that convict period. And at the beginning of the exhibition, there was this description that talked about the people that were in the First Fleet and how it was, you know, it had all these people and there were these six convict ships. And right at the bottom, there was almost a bit of an addendum that sort of went, there were also people that were Jewish and they were people of African descent. And then that was just the end of it. And there was nothing else in the exhibition that spoke to this. There was just, and so again, I kept hearing it, but then I thought, who are these people? And so that was what launched the search into the archives to try and one, verify that they existed, which they do. But then as you would know, you know, you've worked with the archive, once you start looking for one person, more people start showing up and then you're like, oh, okay. So really that was a genesis. Long story, but that was a genesis.
So you had the idea of the book first. Did the documentary come later?
No. So it's funny because once I started, I realized just how once I started, because I was going to be happy with just one person, you know, that was enough evidence for me. And when they started showing up in greater numbers, I began to realize that it was a lot. And I, at the time, I was very keen on making a sort of multimedia visual arts film, you know, and I was going to do it for ACME, which is a museum for the moving image here in Victoria. And I wanted to do that because it was less complicated. I didn't have to get down into the details of it. But a publisher got wind of the fact that I was doing this research because I got a fellowship from the State Library of Victoria. And that fellowship essentially allowed me the time to spend with the archive. And because they, you know, publicly list the things that people are doing and why they're doing them, I met this publisher, and she was a person that said to me that I think that you should turn your research into a book. And I said no straight away. I just said,
really?
Because where do you begin? And also, yeah, it was the year of writing about Australian history, because for the longest time I've always thought that only certain people can write about history. And I didn't see myself as one of those people that could write about history. So it was a lot about overcoming that fear.
Yeah.
And that imposter syndrome. But you know, to Matilda's credit, Matilda Imler, at the time she was a publisher at Picador, to her credit, she was very persistent. She just kept knocking on my door. And I kept saying no until eventually she gave me some money. That kind of got me to think about it a bit differently. So it was, yeah, it was, and it was the same thing with the documentary as well, because SBS had found out that I was doing this research, and because I'm a documentary filmmaker, they said, hey, you know, we'd be really interested in something. And I said, I don't know if I want to do this. It was just, you know, I mean, now 4 years in, it feels even strange talking about it, but at the time, it was all still very new to me. No idea what I wanted to say with these stories. And I doubted my own I doubted my own skill set and whether or not I could do it, you know. But I've been fortunate because I've had incredibly supportive people along the way, that the only person that kept doubting myself was me. Everyone else around me was like, we know you can do it. But yeah, that's kind of how these two projects came about. Didn't go looking for them.
So out of all the convicts that you've researched, was there anyone that you fell in love with? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I do, but I can't talk about it because it's in the book and it's not in the documentary if the book comes out.
Damn. So let's talk about some of the convicts that were in the documentary.
Yeah, in the documentary, there's so many figures. How can you not fall in love with them? John Caesar, you know. So John Caesar was on the First Fleet. He was one of, so we say 10 in the documentary, convicts of African descent on the First Fleet, men and boys. But the official number bounces between 12 and 14. So if you look at Molly Gillen's book, she lists, I think they're about 14. And Cassandra Pybus's Black Founders has something like 12. And the reason why I stick to 10 is that those are the ones that I could verify without a shadow of doubt that they were African. Yep. And so it's a conservative estimate. So they're likely, it's likely they definitely were 14. I just don't know what primary documents Molly Gillen was looking at that confirmed the other four. So we say at least 10, because that can be proof. And they, you know, so Caesar was one of them, and he was formerly enslaved. He would have likely have been freed at some point, because during this time of convict transportation, the slave trade was well and truly underway, because slave trade was abolished in 1807, and slavery itself ended in 1834. So around this period, people of African descent who ended up in the Americas and Europe were often enslaved people. So Caesar would have likely been an enslaved person. How he became free is unclear, because the archive doesn't pick up his presence until he shows up here. And one of the reasons why we know that he was likely a slave was because of his name, Caesar. It's a very common plantation slave name. He ends up here and he is sent to work on Garden Island. And he is described as a very big guy who had a very big appetite, and the rations apparently weren't enough to satisfy Caesar. And he worked very, very hard. He was a hardworking man. But you know, as you know, the first couple of years of that early colony were very difficult, and supplies weren't, especially after the first year, weren't very easy to get here. And so there wasn't an abundance of food and all this sort of stuff. And so the rations did decline quite significantly those first 3 years. This made it very difficult for him, because he, the initial rations weren't already enough. And he would, whenever there were opportunities for him to leave, he would run away, he would abscond. And it started to create a pattern of behavior, of absconding. And it's a very interesting one to read between the lines, because on the one hand, he's sort of actively resisting colonial authorities, and colonial authorities write about him as this, I guess, nuisance to the colony, really. And on the other hand, you sort of wonder how much of that is post-traumatic stress disorder, how much of that is, because again, if he was someone that was enslaved and grew up on a plantation, the systems of punishment were very similar. So during that British Empire period, the ways in which people were displaced were, and their labor exploited, were you were either a slave, or an indentured servant, or a convict. And your rights were determined based on what system you ended up in. But punishment was pretty much the same across all these systems. You were flogged, you were put in chains, you were given rations. So all of these things that Caesar would have grown up in an environment of oppression, all of a sudden he starts experiencing here because he was put in chains, he was flogged. So there's a lot of that, that, and you're on the other side of the world and you don't know what's going on. So you almost wonder how would you react, you know, and would you want to stay in that situation? And so his story is a very interesting one, and it's one that I hope in the future historians can really dive into to really unpack the motivation for him to abscond. I mean, clearly there was the resisting of colonial authority, but also I wonder how much of what he brought with him from where he came from, how much that also informed some of the decisions that he was making, because his time in the colony was very, very short. I think he spent about 7 years before a bounty was put on his head and he was killed. But so he would run away and then he'd be arrested, and then he then, you know, formed a bushranging gang, and they would go around and raid Indigenous camps and other camps and all this sort of stuff. And at the time they were considered very much a threat to the colony. And also, you know, you've got a system that is trying to keep convicts suppressed, and you don't want figures like Caesar who are showing another way of existing in the colony. Yeah. So the only solution is to get rid of them, and that became Caesar's fate. So he's perhaps probably one of the most interesting of figures, and we know that, you know, he's the first convict bushranger, and obviously there have been many others, and he's not the only black convict bushranger. There were others that I've come across in my research as well, but you know, all of them led this wave of resistance, and it's an interesting one as well, because it makes you look at it very, it makes you look at that period very differently to how we generally tend to see it in this binary of good versus bad. And you begin to realize that there's so much complexity, and there's always complexity, obviously. But yeah, so his story probably is one of the first ones that stands out, and one that we tell in the documentary as well. But he was in the First Fleet, and I think he died when he was about 32 when he died, very young.
And John Randall is another interesting character that you talked about in the documentary. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yep, John Randall was also in the First Fleet, and he's sort of a little bit easier to trace compared to Caesar, because their records of him from his origin, place of origin, which is the United States. And John Randall, and this is where him and Caesar's stories, I always see the two as being running in parallel, but class plays a role, and I'll sort of explain why I find their stories quite interesting. So John Randall was also an enslaved person, and during the American War of Independence, the British obviously needed, soldiers and people that were willing to pick up arms for them. And one of the things that they looked at and looked to was to recruit enslaved people, enslaved African Americans, to join their cause. And what they did was that they created an incentive, you know, to get them to enlist, and that was freedom, an offer of freedom. Now, not everyone took up this offer. I don't know if people thought it was too good to be true, who knows, or they were afraid of the consequences of siding with the British. But there were a few thousand that did enlist, and it's very difficult to say if it was of free will, or if there was some sort of, if people were conscripted. It's really difficult to tell, because the power dynamics are so different between an enslaved person and a soldier. so it's very difficult, but what we know is that he did end up fighting for the British. So he definitely was part of that regiment. It was called the Ethiopian Regiment. And obviously the British lost the American War of Independence. And because of that, these soldiers couldn't return to where they were from. They were deemed as loyalists. They were loyalists and they had to leave. And they were sent to Nova Scotia, which is present day Canada. And some of them stayed there, but many others went onward to London, or to England rather. And, London in the 19th century, which a lot of people might find surprising, was very multicultural. There were people that were there from different parts of the world, and but it was also a difficult time because England had been involved in quite a lot of wars, and the economic impact of that was being felt, across the country. So ending up in London as a black man from America, I can't imagine there'd be too many opportunities, for you. I'm trying to remember what he was convicted of. I can't remember from memory. I'd have to check my notes. It's trouble when you've got 500 convicts in your head trying to.
Oh,
remember.
I know.
But he was a watt chain. That's it. It was a watt chain. Randall was a watt chain, this was what led him to, be sentenced to transportation for 7 years. And he ends up in Sydney. And in Sydney, the colonial authorities recognize that he has a skill that he's brought with him. He is a former soldier. And they need, people that can hunt for game for the authorities, and he becomes one of three musket shooters appointed by the governor. And
that's quite a position of trust to,
it is quite a position of
trust. Give a convict to musket.
That's right. And also gives him a bit of power as well. And he also finds himself, because Randall, there were a couple of black convicts are also involved in the Rum Rebellion, and Randall was one of them. He was a drummer, so he was leading the charge to Government House playing the drums. And so you find him at certain significant moments of Australian history, which in itself is quite fascinating. And I think he became a police officer in the New South Wales Corps as well. He later was employed, and he got some land. I think it was something, a large chunk of land that he was able to acquire. And him and John Martin was another black convict that was also on the First Fleet. They sort of had land close to each other, and John Martin married John Randall's daughter, and then they went on and had children, which is why the Randall family tree just keeps on going. And it's just this, it's, I think the estimate was something like 1 in 1,000 Australians descends from John Randall. But at the moment, I think we're officially sticking with hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, sorry, tens of thousands.
I loved how you tracked some down to talk to in the documentary. That was really interesting.
And there's so many of them. There's so many descendants. And again, this is just John Randall, and so, like I said, we know that there were hundreds of others, of other black convicts that were transported here. And also, once transportation ended, a lot more came as free settlers. A lot of Australians today would be very surprised to find that they've got African ancestry. But again, it all makes sense. We like to see ourselves as this island that operates on its own, when the origins of this continent were a result of globalization. We exist because we are a migrant nation. But what I always find very interesting is how we try and create this dissociation as though that's not, you know, that's not who we are. We're in this weird little bubble that is removed from these histories. And it's like, well, no. And you know, if you look at the DNA of a lot of Australians, you will find that it's got a lot of everything. And for some people, they'll be very surprised to realize that they have African ancestry, which I think is great. But, you know, there was a time in this country's history when you couldn't talk about that. So I can also understand why some people would also not be too thrilled about it.
You talked about another interesting character called William Billy Blue. Can you tell us about him?
Story is great, isn't he? He's also a formerly enslaved person. He went through New York, and he finds himself in London, and he was, I think he was making chocolate or something, but yes. he was convicted of stealing sugar and transported to Sydney, and William then becomes quite friendly with Governor Macquarie, and he was also being a former soldier like Randall. I'm trying to remember his origin story. He goes to London, like Randall, he was also involved in the Rum Rebellion as well. He gets to Sydney and he is granted a ferryman license. So before that, actually, Macquarie appointed him as harbour watchman. So he was pretty much in charge of overseeing the North Shore. It's so funny because when you look in the archive, you can see all of these documents of, about him and his time as harbour watchman. And also during that time, because this was in that early part of the colony when rum was the currency, and he shows up in a lot of those sorts of bartering and trading kinds of moments, which in itself is quite interesting. So he's in charge of the harbour, and Macquarie then gives him he then gets granted a license, and he becomes Sydney Harbour's, you know, one of the first ferrymen, and he got very close to Macquarie, and part of it could have been the fact that they both had military backgrounds and they had that in common. But Macquarie entrusted him with the care of his son, young Lachlan. And, you know, Billy would sort of transport him along Parramatta River, and, you know, and he was given land across the North Shore. So where Blue's Point now is in Sydney is part of, was part of Billy's backyard. And he was also somewhat of a socialite in early Sydney. He was quite well known because, you know, there weren't a lot of people like him doing what he was doing. And he was making the most of his opportunities, because coming from being a slave on a plantation to all of a sudden having these harbourside views and, you know, being somewhat of a close acquaintance of the governor, it's a bit of a turnaround in your life's fortunes, that's for sure.
And so many places are named after him.
Blue's Point, I mean, the William Blue Institute is also an institution that's named after him. Macquarie nicknamed him the Commodore. So places like the Commodore Hotel named after him. But what's funny is that a lot of people don't know that he was black. I think people, because of slavery, a lot of these names were anglicized. So the automatic assumption is that this must have been a white dude. and it's not. I love Billy's story. And he like Randall, lived fairly long. Cause Randall, I think, lived until his 80s, and Billy also lived well into his 80s as well. So.
Thank you for coming and talking to us about all of this. It's just been fascinating. I can't wait to read the book and hear about all the other colourful characters in our convict history. When can we see the documentary? When will it be on SBS?
So the documentary airs October 17 on SBS at 7:30 p.m. and they can catch up any time after that via their online platform. I think it's on demand. So from October 17, people will be able to watch it.
Fantastic. I highly recommend it. And the book, when will the book be released and how can we get a copy?
The book comes out sometime next year, and as soon as I have a publication date, you will be the first person to know.
Thank you so much.
but it's been such a joy. I love your podcast. So
thank you. Oh, well, thanks again. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Convict Australia podcast. If you'd like to show your appreciation and get more involved, there are a number of ways you can. The first is by signing up to Convict Australia on Patreon, and you will get some perks like the Convict Australia newsletter. Secondly, leave a review and tell your friends and family. This really does make a huge difference. And lastly, join the Facebook and Instagram group Convict Australia. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes. Thank you again. Till next time.